right now.
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Give countdown.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to the Guy James Show. Thanks for joining us today here on this Thursday, the day after tax day. Yes, the infamous day after tax day. Yes. How was it for you? Wasn't so bad for me this year. Wasn't so bad. Sending out a message here. Yes, it is the 16th of April, and the day after tax day, and the day after all the teabag things that were going on. We're going to have a lot to say about those today. Yeah, I guess we're up and running. Okay, we should be. Everything here in the studio shows that we are. And I wish we could afford to buy hire an engineer. But everything here at the studio shows that we're up and running. So I guess things should be coming along okay. Well, we'll see. Okay. Guess we are up and running okay. Kind of a light, loud crowd in the chat room today. Where is everyone? Out mowing the lawn today? Is that it? Things are so nice that everybody's out mowing the lawn. I know a lot of you saw a lot about these teabagging parties yesterday where they all went out and teabagged one another. Lies and distortions by the local TV and radio station here were abundant. I spoke to a couple of people this morning who attended, and both agreed that the number of attendees, as reported by the local radio station, Wink WNOG Radio and Wink TV, were greatly exaggerated. I saw the video and agreed that it was more like 1,200 than the 3,000 that they reported here locally. This small of a crowd after nonstop promotion by the local stations, by one of its organizers, the local right-wing idiot morning show host Mandy Connell, who I would bet has the lowest IQ of any person on radio in the United States. It was weak tea as far as I was concerned. Fox News promoted it 24/7 along with the right-wing radio show host, and it was, by all accounts, a flop, any unbiased account. Signs Oh, the signs were a hoot. Obama is the Antichrist, some proclaimed. Malbama was on some of the T-shirts. That was in one of the good sellers. Hang 'em High was on another. Pictures of Obama in a Nazi uniform, called him a fascist. I heard one report where they asked this person if Obama was a fascist, and he said yes. And they said, do you know what a fascist is? And they said, well, it's Obama. Well, what is a fascist? Well, it's Obama, but give me the definition of a fascist. And the guy couldn't do it, so, you know, there you are. If the guy with that sign had been in a fascist state, he wouldn't have been holding that sign up very long now, would he? Definitely not. How many black and brown faces did you see in those anti-Obama, anti-American protests yesterday? Really, it was nothing more than a bunch of loons and liars, and really not smart enough to protest what the real problem is. They weren't protesting that corporate America looted all of everybody's bank accounts and 401ks and all that. Odd that they weren't protesting that. And they aren't blaming the Wall Street fat cats. They are blaming Obama for something that started long before he came into office. Really smart people. Hey, we're going to have an interesting show for you today. We're going to have Professor Paul Bohr, M.D., and we're going to talk about bioterror coming up at the bottom of this hour. And then in the next hour, we're going to have, as we tried to do the other day, Richard Gustafson II. He's going to be coming to us from the Sears Tower in Chicago. He is an attorney, and we talked a lot the other day about bankruptcy and all that. And so he's going to give us some advice on all that if anybody needs it. So we'll have a couple of interesting interviews today coming up for you. Good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise and the phone works. But we've certainly tested it out enough today. It should work okay. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254 if you are inclined to comment on the program today. Back to these Tea Party things. They were, as you know, promoted hugely by Fox News and the right-wing groups, and it was a flop. Crowds were way less than the most, than most of the nationwide protests get. You've seen some real protests and gatherings. These were nothing close. For example, Philadelphia had all of 300 people. 300 people in Philadelphia. And when you stop and think about it, given the huge amount of free publicity they got, I'm thinking a bunch of stone teenage anarchists might have organized it better and drawn larger crowds than the tepid teabaggers did. In D.C., where the major protests should have been, they got shut down by security because they didn't have a permit. What a bunch of dopes there. And I did check on over at Fox News, and they were drooling over the whole thing. I briefly saw Glenn Beck at the Alamo, and he had that idiot, what's his name? Ted, I could never get enough guns, Nugent, and some actress I never heard of, I never saw her before, with him, and the crowd was assembled, mostly nutcases who seemed to want Obama's head, and some of the signs they carried said so. And the signage I saw should have been enough to embarrass any decent Republican. I'm sure it would embarrass any decent Republican. I had some of those signs around here. I wonder what I did with that. Here we go again, misplacing something I had. But yes, a lot of signs. And really, the contradiction of this whole thing was amazing. In one breath, they talk about the fundamental violations of natural rights and constitutional law that modern statism, I guess, represents. And in the next breath, they complain at yell at the president for being insufficiently enthusiastic about American imperialism and the national security state. He's too soft on foreigners and not proud enough of the history of the U.S. war machine. And there's still a key right-wing criticism of Obama, right along with contradictory claim that Obama puts love of the national government ahead of individual rights. So which is it? They couldn't seem to decide. And I thought the classic line yesterday, someone else pointed this out to me, and I agree that the classic line came from Neil Cavuto when, after Glenn Beck was talking to him, he said, "Glenn, that was your Evita moment." I thought that was beautiful. And I saw Laura Ingraham speaking at the huge, I say huge, maybe 200 people, at Lafayette Park across from the White House, and she was thanking everybody for taking the day off work to come to the protest. Notice she didn't take the day off work to go to the protest. And she said that when people on the left demonstrate, they never have to miss work, but they're, because they're nothing but a bunch of lazy, good-for-nothing malcontents who don't have jobs. And it was interesting, if you travel around the internet and the newspapers around the country and the TV and the radio, it was interesting how similar the recaps were right down to the crowd estimates, especially on the Fox affiliates. The fear of socialism, European style to Russian style, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, part of me, a very small part of me, feels a little sorry for these folks, but just a little bit. They obviously don't understand modern civil society. I feel like they've been cheated, and they have been. The only thing is their understanding of just who's cheating them and how is about as close to zero as it gets. They really don't understand who's cheating them out of everything that they've got. In fact, they stubbornly insist on believing in the very con artist, or I guess you'd call them neo-con artists, who lead them around like sheep, which is why my pity for them is somewhat limited. And if they were just merely ignorant, that'd be one thing, but there's a certain aggression to their ignorance, an element that seeks to bring society down to their level of stupid, and that's pretty low. And that makes us all worse off, in my opinion. And here you got Fox News host Neil Cavuto in Sacramento, California, talking with a producer. And he got caught live on the mic, with a live mic. Cavuto's talking to his producer, and these are actual quotes. I saw the video. I couldn't get the audio for you. Cavuto says to his producer, "Any estimates on how many people are here?" And his producer said, "No, we're trying to get..." And Cavuto said, "There's got to be 5,000. And the producer said, "Oh, at least. You know, I mean, the cops aren't going to tell us, and we've been trying to get a hold of the PR person to give us their number, but I think 5,000, you can say it's starting at 5,000. And so Cavuto goes on the air 10 minutes later and says, "I know you cover a lot of these things, Shep, but you're probably better at estimating crowd sizes than I am. They're expecting 5,000 here, but it's got to be easily double, if not triple that." So in a matter of 10 minutes, Cavuto raised his number from 5,000 to 15,000 with no official count on it. And to recap, off the air, Cavuto is recorded estimating the crowd at 5,000. And on the air, he said it's easily doubled or triple that. So there you go. Fox reports and you decide. And there's not much to decide right there. He's just a flat-out liar. Not much else you can say about it. And in the realm of protest yesterday, of course, there were protests in Texas. And they had some of these just about in about all the states. I think they covered all 50 states. Some more than others. But in Texas, they've had their little rallies down there, and the one at the Alamo, and I think they had one in Dallas and Fort Worth and Houston and all that. And they made the mistake of letting Governor Rick Perry talk publicly again. And just so you'll know about Rick Perry, if you don't know about Rick Perry, there was a bumper sticker going around Texas when Junior Bush left office down there and took over the White House. There was a bumper sticker that went around and had pictured Junior's face on it and said, "If you think I'm bad, wait till you see who's following me." And thus, we have Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, and probably no more of an idiot there ever occupied a state house. Lord, please tell me there's no one any dumber than Rick Perry ever occupied a state house. But He is the governor. They've got a great tradition here, the last two governors, don't they? You can add both their IQs together, and you wouldn't have, you know, like the saying goes, if the brains were dynamite, you wouldn't have enough to blow your nose. But Perry and some of the people in Texas, and even old Glenn Beck with him, and Chuck Norris, and some others, talking about seceding from the Union. Now, my apologies to all of my friends in Texas. You have time to get out, by the way. But Texas seceding, finally. Go for it, guys. Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. My opinion, good riddance. If you've listened to this program over the years, you know I'm not enamored with the state of Texas. You got your Tom DeLay, your George Bush, Bill Graham, Daddy Bush, Barbara Bush, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Ollie North, Karl Rove, Kenneth Copeland, Pastor John Hagee, Joel Osteen, Robert Tilton. My, that's a haven for those kinds of fellows, isn't it? You got your Mark David Chapman, your John Hinckley Jr., your David Koresh, Jonathan Pollard, Tex Watson, the Dealey Plaza. For my money, any state that legitimately elects a George W. Bush twice could go ahead and hit the road as far as I'm concerned. I never liked Texas. I will never like Texas. So take your Lone Star, take your Dallas Cowboys, take all your phony, baloney, biggest and best crap and form your own country. Then I'll be for building a fence on the border to keep a lot of the Texans out of our country. Just think about it. Then they'll be able to form their own army and invade Mexico. And while you're at it, Texas, why not form a confederacy? Yeah, that's it. You can get some other states to go with you. Like South Carolina, for example. They seem to love this sort of secessionist crap. And how about Georgia and Alabama and Tennessee and Mississippi and Louisiana and Arkansas for good measure? Hell, go for it. Most of the states I just mentioned get the largest share, percentage-wise, of our tax money. And they're the ones bitching the most. Texas, for example, gets back 88 cents of every dollar they pay into the feds. 88 cents. Minnesota, however, for a comparison, gets back 42 cents. So go. And take every goddamn redneck, coon-hunting, tobacco-spitting cowboy with you. The rest of us would be a whole lot better off. Do it, Rick. Do it. Secede. I'll back you all the way. I will. I'll contribute to any fund you start to get the ball rolling. I'd be happy to do that. They're actually talking seriously about this, a lot of them. And I got to tell you, it is fine with me. Fine with me. We wouldn't have to get any more of their politicians in our office, in our national office, now would we? There's something about politicians from Texas. What is it? Is it in the water? Must not be in the water, because there's some fine folks in Texas that drink the same water. But I am. I'm tired of it. I hate the attitude of Texas. We're the biggest. We're the best. All this. You know, there's a limit to the that amount of crap that you can take, and I've had my limit a long time ago. I never was really thrilled about Texas. It's a vast wasteland for the most part. But then I went down to Crawford that time. And I had a chance to wade knee-deep into the sludge that is backwoods Texas. And, oh, my God, what a lesson on Texas that was for me. Deep in the heart of Texas right there. I pulled into Crawford, Texas, and hey, there's a lot of little podunk towns around this country. Lots of them. Most of them are great. Most of them got friendly people. But Crawford, Texas, no other way to put it than it's a hellhole. That's all I can say. That's the best thing I can say about it. The people were antagonistic, hostile, didn't like outsiders, didn't like anybody, didn't want anything to do with anybody that wasn't white and Texan and Republican. Because they're a fair-haired boy. Lived just outside of town on Prairie Chapel Road, just off of Prairie Chapel Road. Doesn't live there anymore, but he lives in Dallas now. I wonder what he did with his ranch. Will he save that for a weekend retreat, or will he sell it? You know, the land around there where his ranch is can't be worth $10 an acre. When they talk about him going out and cutting brush, they aren't kidding. There's nothing out there. Nothing. Didn't see any crops. I don't know what you could grow. I did see an elevator in town, a silo, so there must be some kind of grain someplace around there. But without question, the ugliest place I've ever been in the United States. I can't think of anything uglier than Crawford, Texas. Hell, Cleveland's prettier than Crawford, Texas. Detroit's prettier than Crawford, Texas. Now imagine that. I'm just having fun with you. But not about Crawford. My apologies to the Detroit people and the Cleveland people. And it just was all the uglier because George Bush was from there. And just all the uglier because Daddy Bush inhabited the place. And moreover, is a lot uglier because Barbara Bush lived there. Such a fine, fine piece of womanhood she is. Raised a couple of really terrific sons. A whole bunch of three, four of them, Marvin, con artist, Junior, dumber than a fence post, Jeb, another extraordinary con man. Raised quite a nice family there, the Bushes did. Some of you might think I'm biased about that, but I'm not. I mean what I said about Texas. I really do. So, Rick, old buddy, if you're thinking seriously about bailing, you got my blessing. Please do. I'll do whatever I can do to help. 866-546-5254. We're going to have Professor Paul Boer on in just a couple of minutes to talk about bioterrorism. I want to thank those of you that have contributed in our fund drive. Let me see here. We got, what did I do with that list? Well, it's around here somewhere. We got John and Sophie and Chuck and another John. Chuck and John must be brothers, those two. And we've got, the lady from California. I'm trying to think of her name. Anyway, I've tried to write back to each and every one of you and let you know my thanks, and I'll keep you posted on the blog. That's thegyjamesshow.com/blog, and I'll put something up on there later today about our progress on our fundraising drive. We're not making huge progress, but at least, as they say in basketball, we've got the lid off the basket. And I do thank those of you who have contributed to the program. 866-546-5254, if you'd like to call us. We're going to hang on about two more minutes yet, and then we're going to take a break and get our guest on the line, our guest for today. Teabagging. I wonder if any of those folks, you think about all the thousands of tea bags that were wasted yesterday, or symbolic tea, I guess some of it was. I heard they had 1 million tea bags in Washington, D.C., and They didn't get a permit, so they couldn't dump them in Lafayette Park. And they couldn't dump them in the Potomac. I wonder what they did with them. They took them down to some right-wing think tank and put them on display. I know that. I don't know how big a container a million tea bags is. But it was all hilarious yesterday, and I do thank them for the entertainment. I do. From what I saw, it was very entertaining. The local female gas bag on in the morning here, she had a good time with it. So if that's what floats your boat, why go for it? Doesn't take a whole lot to get her excited, evidently. God, that woman's acts so stupid. I wish all of you could... I'll tell you what you should do. If you want to get an idea of how stupid this woman is that I'm talking about, and I wish you would so you can know where I'm coming from on this. Google Wink WNOG Radio, Wink WNOG Radio, and you'll see they have a morning show that comes on, I think, at 5:30 and lasts up until 9 o'clock, right up till Glenn Beck time, right before Rush Limbaugh time, right before Hannity time, right before Mark Levin time, right before who else after that, I don't know. But Google that, Wink WNOG Radio, and listen live at 6 o'clock in the morning till 9 for Mandy Connell, and see if you don't agree that she's one of the dumbest people that you ever heard on the radio in your life. I can't get over that anybody that would put her in front of a microphone. I really can't. She's the one I mentioned that gets the newspaper out every morning, and that's her show prep. She gets the newspaper out and goes through the newspaper, picking out stories and talking about them. Oh, how interesting that is. Hey, we're going to pause for a break right now, and we will hopefully get our guest on the line and be back in just a couple of minutes. Yes, we do. At long last. I apologize for the problems with that we had the other day, and we're finally all set. We've got this new phone system, and we're not exactly sure about it yet, but anyway, we're connected today, and that's a good thing.
We just have too many phones around, don't we?
Oh, don't we, though? Everybody's got a handful of phones these days, and just way too many landlines and all that. First of all, welcome to the show, and we talk a lot about terrorism on the program and the effects it has on our people and the effects it has had on our people. First of all, tell us a little bit about your expertise, your field of learning, and what you're involved with in the field of bioterrorism.
Well, I'm a researcher, and I've been doing research for a number of years here at the University of Texas Medical Branch, and it just so happens that we happen to have started back before 9/11, actually, one of the largest efforts in infectious diseases. And so a lot of us are involved in research that's related to bioterrorism or, you know, research that's related to infectious diseases, really, on a basic level. So I'm a basic scientist. And you know, I come to you because I wrote a novel which has to do with sort of a worst-case scenario of inside the lab.
Oh, it sure does. It sure does have a worst-case scenario. Great book, by the way.
Well, thank you. I've
not read many novels in the past few years, but this one grabs you and pulls you in, and it's very realistic. It's
good, yeah.
Highly.
That's what I was trying for, right?
Yes, very realistic. I see your governor and Chuck Norris and a couple other people. You might not be in the United States very much longer. They're talking about secession down there. Yeah, I'm making a joke. I talked a little earlier today about your governor there. But you have one of the most secure labs in the country, do you not?
Yes. That's true to say, yeah.
What is it called? Forgive me for not knowing. You say, is it a level four, or you want to explain?
Biosafety, we have actually two biosafety level four laboratories and several biosafety level threes, of course, too, also. And these labs, the first one was actually, like I say, started. It's a smaller lab that was started before 9/11 because of all the interest of us researchers here. And the larger one is called the Galveston National Lab. That's a regional level four type lab, and what that means is researchers come from more or less the whole central part of the country, even as far north as, you know, Illinois, to come here and do research in that laboratory. So it's a regional government lab, basically.
Well, what is exactly a biosafety laboratory? What makes it more safe than the others?
The point of it is that you can use organisms that are highly dangerous or unknown, like Ebola, things like that, that we don't understand exactly how they're spread, those go into a level four. Things that we know that are spread through aerosol, like tuberculosis, and even you might be surprised to know that anthrax, for instance, are really level three because we understand more about them, we know how they're spread, and so they can be contained with sort of the glove box type. And you've seen that ad where the person has the gloves into the box, and he or she is doing the research inside of a laboratory box, basically. That's a level three type. The level four, we walk right into it. It's like described in the book. You walk into it in a spacesuit. You hook up to an air hose, and you do the work inside there, you know, inside of your spacesuit, basically. And when you come out, you go through a chemical shower and unclothe. And it's a real process. You go in there for hours on end.
Well, the correlation there with the spacesuit and the chemical shower—that's because what you have in there is more dangerous than the level three, or it's just
right.
More really. What is more dangerous than an anthrax, for example?
Well, because we know how anthrax is generally spread and how it exists in nature and the disease it causes in nature too. Even a bioweapon with anthrax needs to be inhaled. And so the inhalation aspect of it keeps it a level three, because we understand it. Ebola, West Nile virus, the bird flu, most of the hemorrhagic fevers that are spread probably by mosquito bite, but we're not really too clear. Anything that's unknown, an unknown virus that's the so-called emerging or something that's new, that comes under level four because we don't really know how it's spread, so it's potentially more dangerous. Ebola, for instance, as an example, is a very peculiar disease because we don't know why it seems to be sort of endemic in areas of Africa and not get out of there, and yet people who go there and visit can contract it. It's not as highly infectious as you might think, and so, you know, we don't really understand how it's spread from person to person. So because of that, it's into the level four.
I see.
Smallpox is level four because that's a really highly infectious disease.
Well, if a bioterrorist wanted to do terrible damage. And, of course, the worst damage that they do is probably not the numbers of people they would kill, but it would be the psychological effects, I think. Or am I completely wrong in that?
No, actually, you're right. That's exactly true. And the anthrax attacks actually bring that out, because the lethality-wise, it was, what, 5 or 6 people, but, you know, it basically shut down markets and travel and all sorts of other things that could happen. Or even if you think about 9/11, of course, that was a horrible, horrible thing, but the thing that did the stock markets for the following year, so, you know, it was really pretty striking.
Yes.
So you wouldn't need too many casualties or, you know, to make a big scare.
Is that the aim of the terrorist, to just cause terror, or is it their aim to kill as many as possible? Probably both.
I think probably both, you know, are... When people envision what an attack would be like, it might be in several places, you know, urban area. There might be some sort of disease that was brought in by, you know, a suicide bomber type person, somebody with a disease who comes into an area and then infects other people, rather than an anthrax type thing, although that's a possibility too. I mean, that's another distinct possibility of a typical, you know, like by mail or by some other route, spreading that kind of thing around, so that, again, like you say, it would be more of the terror, more of the effect, the fear, and people, of course, being quarantined and not traveling and all that sort of thing, commerce shutting down. I guess, you know, that it'd be worrisome.
Now, the anthrax, that is strictly airborne. That's not something that you could dump in the water, or is it? It's just strictly an airborne problem.
Well, from the point of view of a bioweapon, that's right. The way that a person takes that bug and makes it into a weapon is to grow it up in large quantities and to so-called weaponize it or mix it with some sort of powdery stuff so that it can be spread in the air and go down into people's lungs and then cause so-called pulmonary anthrax. Anthrax is, you know, it's been around a long time, and it's contracted as a skin disease, skin and, you know, a deep, bad skin disease from animals, and, you know, Louis Pasteur experimented in the middle of the square with anthrax to show immunity by injecting, you know, by rubbing it into somebody and you know, showing that they were immune to it after a previous, you know, following a previous exposure. So a little bit of anthrax in the natural state is not a deadly killer, but in the pulmonary form it is. So that's what we mean when we say weaponized.
Well, what kind of a delivery device would a terrorist use, and how much anthrax would they have to, let's say, over a New York City or a big urban area?
Well, they'd have to have a lot. There was in fact, the chairman of my department investigated an accidental anthrax exposure that occurred in Russia, and showed pretty conclusively that it did occur there, and that was in a village, which was a fairly good-sized town of several thousand people, that it was exposed accidentally when there was release from one of these factories some years ago, maybe 20, 25 years ago, when the Russians, Soviet Union, was producing a lot of anthrax as a bioweapon. And so this bioweapon, this actual, you know, weaponized anthrax, got out in the town, and a couple hundred people died. So that gives you an idea that if a small plane dumped a bunch of it over a town, you could kill potentially hundreds of, maybe even more, people with it, or at least and cause a lot of disease besides the ones who died. So, but again, you would need weaponized quantities of it, which is really like pounds, you know, not just a little test tube of it.
How hard is it to produce a pound of anthrax?
Well, you do need a laboratory. It's not real easy. One of the problems is, similar to nuclear weapons, we know that this stuff has been produced as a weapon before, and so one wonders if there are stockpiles of it somewhere. We certainly know that the Soviet Union had quite a bit of it at one time. I don't believe our country ever made any of it in a weaponized way. And then who else? I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm not in the government. I'm not in the bioterrorism, you know, security aspect of it. I'm a scientist, so I'm just telling you what my thoughts are, but certainly that's a possibility that there's some around that could be used in that kind of way.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Boer, the bioscientist and also author of The Blood Notes of Peter Mallow, a book that you'll all want to pick up. You can get that just about anywhere now, can't you?
Well, yeah, my website is a good place to start, or online at Amazon. The big bookstores have it in their system, like Borders and Barnes & Noble and so forth, and so they can get it usually in a day or so. But my website, Paul Boor, BOOR.com, is a good place to start, because you can get it from Amazon or directly from the publisher there.
Okay.
I'll also read a few pages, too, and it's got cool, scary music that comes on at the beginning.
Yes. Yeah, the cool, scary music. If somebody were serious about this, how about smallpox, for example? One of my listeners is asking about, is smallpox on the rise worldwide again, and wasn't it almost eliminated at one time, and would people use a smallpox for a bioweapon of some kind?
Well, your first question, yes, it was, or statement really, it has been virtually eliminated. And that's really why it's only used in one laboratory in the United States, and that's at the CDC. They have there are four, basically, of these high-level BSL-4 labs. We have ours here, and there's one in San Antonio and Fort Detrick, and then in the CDC in Atlanta. And Atlanta is the only place, that government facility, is the only one that can experiment with, developing vaccines, experimenting with smallpox and how it acts in animals and that sort of thing. So, yes, it's almost been eradicated. There's very little research that's going on except there on it. Now, there occasionally is a report of an outbreak, and to tell you the truth, I'm not sure when the last one was, but it seems like it was several years ago where there was some isolated. But it's really not a major problem anywhere. However, it is one of those bugs that one worries about if someone should somehow get a hold of a stock of it and infect a bunch of people and use those people as suicide bomber types. It is a potential bioweapon, so it's in that list of bioweapons, or select agents, as they call them, as a potentially very dangerous one. Again, it's spread very rapidly from person to person, and many, especially any of us baby boomer types, have had vaccinations to it. But there's a question about how effective even those older vaccinations would be if there were to be an outbreak. So
why?
So there are a lot of questions. Well, because it's so long since the vaccination time, and there's been no exposure really to test the efficacy of how well we're vaccinated, probably we're okay. But the vaccination program for smallpox is not a major thing that's been used for years, so there are a lot of people who are not vaccinated. So, I guess it's in that list of select agents for those reasons.
Yellow fever, all these things, are these things that less sophisticated terrorists would use? Or is that just as hard to get a hold of a strain of smallpox and yellow fever and all that?
Those I think are very difficult to get a hold of, but it would have to come from, you'd have to have access to a real scientific laboratory. It'd be difficult. That's not the kind of thing that could be done in somebody's garage very easily. Just because, you have to use a level 4 in order to grow it up and to make it infective. I'm not sure how yellow fever would work, because that disease is pretty much known to be spread by mosquitoes. And so there are pockets of yellow fever. In some places it's quite a problem. But how to spread it among, people in an attack would be kind of difficult. Most of the hemorrhagic fevers are a little bit hard to do that way. It's more the unknown ones, like Marburg virus, which is an African virus that's of some interest now, that's very similar to Ebola. We don't really know much about it. We don't know if that could be used as a bioweapon. A lot of the issues about bioattacks are not only, these things we're talking about, but how we would react to one. If you remember, for instance, the fellow who got on the plane with the highly resistant tuberculosis.
Yes.
Well, when he realized what was going on with him, they had to find a level 3 type treatment facility. In other words, a hospital room that's totally secluded and aerosol safe, and people go in there with an N95, you know, respirator on. So all the things that are necessary for level three laboratory kind of are in that, you know, facility. So they had to find that kind of thing. So if there were the kind of outbreak in which you'd need level three, like for anthrax, for instance, level three facilities for the patients, the people who had it, to isolate them and so forth, that's when the kind of things you worry about is our hospital system and our diagnostic system, able to handle that. And then, of course, there's treatment. Is there enough drug around for an antiviral or whatever to treat adequately, and how fast can you make it? And then also, of course, one of the things that's pretty much connected to most of our scientific facilities is some sort of vaccine, making a facility or a vaccine institute in our case, where they're making vaccines, not only, you know, for potential bioterrorism use, but also for, like, for instance, yellow fever or Japanese encephalitis and many other diseases that are present in the world that, you know, that we need vaccines for, basically, or improved vaccines.
Well, you're around that kind of thing. It's old hat to you, I suppose, but what's it make you feel like going in a facility like this, knowing that there are these deadly things all over the place, or not all over the place, but what do you feel like when you go in there?
Well, these things are pretty scary, but at the same time, if you're a scientist and scientists have traditionally, this is one of the things I'm very interested in my fiction really too, is scientists have always had a pretty risky job. And if you think back to many of the very early scientists, Marie Curie and even the guys who worked on the atomic bomb, a lot of those people died of exposures to things that they didn't really know what, you know, how bad they were.
Yeah.
They were radiating themselves, and Marie Curie had worked with radium on the benchtop, you know, and exposed herself and had probably leukemia and so forth. So, you know, scientists have a pretty dangerous job. So, and there are going to be accidents, and we do have accidents, and they're reported and they're dealt with, and, you know, proper things are taken. The thing that you really worry about is, you know, sticking yourself with a needle, like people get AIDS in the hospitals today, you know, from those kinds of accidents. So those are the things that are most worrisome. Breaking test tubes or breaking things in a level four is not a big problem because you have to shut the whole thing down and basically pump the room full of formaldehyde gases basically to kill everything. You get out of there and, you know, you're in the suit and so forth. So that's why we have all these protections. So in a way, it's not any more nerve-wracking, I guess, than getting on an airplane or maybe getting on I-45 and driving to Houston, which is...
Oh, listen to this. Listen to this, folks. He's talking about being on his... No more. Okay, I'm going to take your word for that. One of the things that probably scares me most, and I think after the incident that we had, I can't think of the fellow's name anymore, the incident that we had here a year or two ago, well, maybe it's been longer than that.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. We have. Yes. We've got our own. So.
If I can take a break, hold on.
That's the first dog break I think we've ever taken. Either he's got a real sound.
Yeah, a lot of things going on in Galveston here, and part of it is workmen coming to the door to look at your damages. You know, we've had this.
Oh, yes, so. And you got hit pretty hard with that. You personally, didn't you?
Yes, very much so.
Well, we're not bothered by that. That's what dogs are supposed to do when strangers come to the house.
And that's one of the things that comes up with the laboratories, of course, too, is the hurricanes.
Yeah.
And you'll be happy to know that our Galveston National Lab went through this last hurricane because it was a recently built building with virtually no damage. So, you know, the people will say, well, why did they build a lab like that on a hurricane-prone island? Well, in reality, most of the bugs that we use would probably be killed if they were put under a lot of salt water, for instance. And we do so much preparation for a storm when they're coming that really, that's the least of my worries. The things I worry about more are the kind of things like I address in the book, which is, you know, in, the inside story, you know, the crazy person in a lab. Or,
yes, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. We had this, we think we had this incident of that with this fellow with the anthrax over in the East Coast. I can't think of his name now. We think we think that's what happened. I guess all indications prove that we kind of know that happened. There are some doubts about it, but isn't that a problem? Is there enough security? What kind of security do you have to go through? And is there enough stringent security to protect the public from? And just like in the book, somebody that's has lost it and. That's a problem, isn't it?
Off the deep end. And
yes.
I mean, clearly this guy, Bruce Ivins, and I did not know him personally, although I've read some of his work, and he definitely was in a vaccine, you know, kind of research mode. If he had really done it, he would have had to learn a lot of new things about weaponizing organisms and so forth. But in any case, whether he's, you know, guilty or not in the press, you know, it certainly sounded bad. And he was very imbalanced. You know, there's no question about the fact that he was unbalanced. So there's this potential to have unbalanced people have access to laboratories, I think. Certainly if you think about, like, the astronauts, there's a group of highly selected people. I mean, how much more selection can you have than to become an astronaut? But we know that they can go off the deep end sometimes and do crazy things personal reasons, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, one worries about that. So as far as our laboratories, these kinds of laboratories, there's a lot of, it takes a long time to get to work in one of these. It probably takes, you know, you're going to have a pretty strong background scientifically for a number of years as a student and a postdoctoral student and so forth before you get close to one and you sort of work your way up. You just have to have a certain amount of research experience in a level 2 and a level 3 before you get near a level 4. And then there's the training, of course, under level 4. So, and that takes a number of months, and that's under very close supervision before you...
Who runs the security for that?
Well, we have, for each lab, there's one designated scientist who runs the program, and then there are a number of people who do the training. About 4 or 5 people who actually do the training. So there's a group of people. And I think, you know, I don't think we need more levels of administrators, more levels of, you know, of bureaucracy to check these things out. But I think what has to be developed is a very close relationship among the scientists. And that's where, so that if there's somebody who's a little weird and is doing strange experiments, It gets known by the scientists and the students and the postdocs and everyone who's on the team. So I think really a close-knit team of people is the key to security. I mean, from the point of view of, you know, a crazy person in the lab, obviously we have all kinds of security. I mean, you have to card yourself in and out, and there's cameras all over. There are all sorts of ways to pick up, you know, just somebody who tries to walk away with something in the lab or something. So there are a lot of federal regulations about access to the lab, even getting on that block. You know, you can't drive a big vehicle even close to the, or go up there with a motorcycle or something, you know, to even close to the laboratory. So there are a lot of those sort of physical, you know, policing type things. But what I'm talking about is the experiments that are being done and the work that's being done with the dangerous organisms. And that's really, the way that's checked is amongst the peers who are working in those groups there. And so I think that's really the key. And like in my book, you know, there's a kind of a goofy, crazy student, and the scientist is distracted by lots of things. Peter Mallow has all sorts of strange things going on in his life, and he's got a love life and so forth. And he's under the gun getting funding, which happens to everyone and happens to us almost on a daily basis, you know, as scientists try and get our experiments funded. So there's a lot of things that go on, and the checkpoints are really the other scientists and the surrounding, you know, the work group, I think, that needs to be strong. And so that's why you need a critical mass to have one of these labs.
Sure. Well, tell me, that leads me to the question, why did you write this book? Why did you write this kind of a book? It seems to me it seems to me that maybe it's not all fiction.
Yes, it's real science fiction, if you will. In other words, it's a real science story. I wrote it to show what the life of a scientist is like, partly, you know, with a very realistic look at a sort of a regular person. Because I think many people think, you know, scientists are kind of weird and they just lock themselves in their lab.
And they think of Boris Karloff and what's his name? I can't think of the other one.
The mad scientist.
Yes.
Idea, yeah.
Yes.
And partly that's true.
Oh, really?
A lot of us are a little bit of loners and maybe, you know, have a kind of over-dedication to the job, you know, that idea of science is, you know, as being your whole career. Because it is a tough job. You have to deal with funding, and it's easy to fail. It's a lot of training before you really get to do what you want, and there's a lot of pressure. So it's a funny kind of a profession, I guess. But at the same time, there are real people doing it. We're not all automatons, you know. So that inside story, and also, and the good part of that, I mean, the excitement of science, I tried to get some of that in, the excitement of discovery and understanding biology is really why we do it, and in the case of biomedical science anyway. And so I wrote it because of that, and but mostly I wrote it because I like to write, and it sounded like a great setting, you know, a great potential story to
that
inside of a, you know, high-level laboratory, just as a sort of they're opening up across the country, too.
Especially with the kind of news we've had the last couple of years. I see your point about the scientists. You know, when I was referring to myself, when I was in high school, I had a big love of astronomy. And I had every intention of studying that. And after I got to thinking about that for a while, I thought, you know, I'm a curious guy. And if I take up astronomy for my life's work, I'll never, ever get the answers that I want. I know I'll never find out what it is I want to know. And so I decided that it would be frustrating for me. Do you ever have a sense of frustration like that?
Oh, absolutely. You have a lot of the frustration comes from the amount of, you know, new things that you learn, new things that you discover. That for the average scientist, you know, I guess I am an average scientist, you know, you can count those on one hand. And that's a whole career, you know, good part of a career. So we try and, you know, advance knowledge in our own individual fields, but it's a kind of a stutter-start process. It's not like you know, sometimes there's a great discovery, and clearly there are people who win Nobel Prizes and so forth, but the vast majority of us are just have to be satisfied with the inventions or the little bit of advances and the little bit of discoveries that they come across. So,
and are you?
Yeah, I am. There's a few things that I've been very interesting that I've published. I mean, from the science point of view, and my lab is still active, and I mean, you know, I'm still on top of the game here. So that's kind of fun, which is tough because I try and write every day. Because I'm working on another novel, of course.
Your other novel that you've been working on, didn't you win some kind of an award with it?
Yes, actually, yeah, I had two others that are in the formative. Actually, one's being shopped around now to publishers, and the other's in the formative state. And yeah, they won both, in which was unheard of actually at a fairly big national kind of contest, which is the Texas Writers League of Austin. It's a very active group that's been there for 20-some years, and it's a very active writing kind of group, and I put in a couple of novels. The second one is, I'm interested in a historical biomedical thriller, if you can fathom that. I mean, it's set in the older medical schools, but it still has a science theme in which there's a scientist, you know, dealing with daily problems, that kind of thing.
I see you just had to get Harvard in there somewhere.
Oh yeah, that's one of my novels too. Yeah, I set it in Boston because I spent so many years there and loved the city. And so I did have one that's my other one that's still kind of in the closet right now, or in the drawer, I guess you'd call it.
Yes.
I haven't sent that around to publishers yet, but I have an excellent agent, and he's kind of guiding me along as to what I should be working on.
Well, I do want to highly recommend The Blood Notes of Peter Mallow. It's a book that'll keep you riveted. Like I said, there's fact and fiction woven together in it, and it makes for a compelling read. It really does, and I'm kind of anxious to see your new one as well when it comes out. Professor Bora, I'd like to thank you so much for being on the program today. You've given us a lot of insight into a most interesting and timely subject, and we appreciate it so very much here on the Guy James Show. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And your website again once more before we go?
Simply Paul Boor, B-O-O-R, .com.
Okay, that's simple enough. It certainly is. Everybody head on over there, see that, and get that book. And thank you, Professor.
All right, thank you. Have a good day.
Bye. It would be interesting to follow him around for a day at work, would it not? My, oh, my, it certainly would. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We're going to pause for news at the top of the hour, and we'll be back in just a minute or two. Don't go away.
In New York State, the Civil Service Employees Association says Governor David Patterson is trying to use anti-union politics to solve his state's budget crisis. The CSEA says Governor Patterson's threat to lay off 9,000 corrections, state police, and mental health workers unless unions accept concessions endangers public safety. CSEA's Steve Medeiros says the governor is carrying out an anti-union political agenda.
He's not interested in anything that we could come up with to save the state money short of reopening the contracts. This is really tantamount to union busting.
New Jersey's Civil Service Commission has denied a request to delay an emergency furlough rule from being implemented. Jesse Russell has more.
As a result, New Jersey Governor John Corzine announced yesterday he would move forward with plans to implement one-day furloughs in May and June. The unions representing the state workers argue that the furlough days, which amount to pay cuts, are in violation of worker contracts. An appellate court is expected to hear arguments from both sides today. Some state workers will be exempt from the furlough ruling, including state troopers and corrections officers.
UPS is planning to cut 11% of its worldwide workforce. The number would amount to 8,700 job cuts by the year 2010. The Swiss bank had already announced plans in October of last year to slash 2,000 jobs in the U.S. and United Kingdom. The company didn't specify on Wednesday where the additional job cuts would be made.
Here is today's economic report. If you hear a hissing sound, don't worry. It's only the U.S. economy. According to The Guardian, for the first time since August of 1955, the U.S. economy is deflating. The consumer price index dropped by 0.4% in March. The main reason is a drop in energy costs during the month, which fell by 3%, with gasoline prices dropping by 4%.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
God bless America.
And the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
Do you believe the things they
Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Good to have you along with us this afternoon. Oh, yes. It's a beautiful day here in Southwest Florida. And I hope it's nice where you are as well. I guess it can't be nice everywhere, but it is a beautiful, beautiful day here. And we're at that time of year when we've got, you know, 80, 84, 85 degree weather almost every day. Once in a while, it'll dip down into the 70s, high 70s next week for a couple of days, they say. But basically, we've got spectacular weather this time of year. And I guess that's why so many people come here for the winter. It'll be heating up soon, though. We're coming up to the time where it'll be 95 and humid every single day unless we get the sea breeze. And fortunately, I live a place where we get the sea breeze. So I'm not at all uncomfortable with the heat. You sit out in it all day, it'll get to you. But I like summers. I like winters. I like fall. And I like spring here. So it's a nice period. We've got coming up here in just a couple of minutes another guest on a very timely subject. We're going to talk about personal bankruptcy with Richard Gustafson II, and he has offices in the Sears Tower, I guess for soon to be known as something else. We'll have to ask him about that. Soon to be known as something other than the Sears Tower. Someone else bought the naming rights to it or something or other. I'm not exactly sure what happened there, but we'll be getting him on the line in just a couple of minutes, so stay with us for that. It's interesting what he has to say about personal bankruptcy, and there are a lot of people finding out right now. There is a huge number of personal bankruptcies taking place all across the country. I see foreclosures are up again by 24% this past month. So I don't know about this economy getting better right now. Yes, there is some real estate selling, but if you've got money, I suppose it's a good time to buy. Seems like prices are as low as they get. I certainly hope they are. Hope they won't go any lower than that right now. Hate to think about that. I'm going to pause for a quick break, and we'll get our guest on the line, and we'll be right back.
Calling to reschedule your appointment or need directions to our office, please press 5.
Nothing like library.
If you are a creditor or collection agency calling for the case status regarding one of our clients, press 6.
We're doing this live with this new
phone.
Thank
you for calling Legal Helpers, a service of the law firm of Macy and Alleman. If you are a first-time caller, please press 1.
Oh, boy.
If you are a current client, please press 2. Para continuar en español, marque tres.
No.
If you are a trustee, creditor's attorney, or are calling from a judge's chambers, please press 4.
A judge's chambers.
If you are calling to reschedule your appointment or need
directions
to our office,
that either.
Please press 5. If you are a creditor or a collection agency calling for the case status regarding one of our clients,
creditor.
Press 6. Thank you for calling Legal Helpers, a service of the law firm of Macy and Alleman. If you are a first-time caller, please press 1. If you are a current client, please press 2. Para continuar en español, marque 3. If you are a trustee, creditor's attorney,
or calling from
a judge's chambers, please press 4. If you are calling to reschedule your appointment or need directions to our office,
please
press 5. If you are a creditor or a collection agent,
I love
calling
this.
For the case status regarding
Let's
one of our clients.
Let's see, where can we go
Pass
here
six.
To get the right...
The collection agencies pay our attorney's fees. For more information...
Good afternoon, law office. Are you a current client?
I'm calling for Richard Gustafson. I have an appointment. He told me to tell you that it's urgent for a radio interview.
Your name, sir?
Guy James.
Guy James?
Yes.
Let me let him know you're on hold.
All right.
Consumer bankrupt.
Hey, how about this? You guys get in on everything.
Our experienced
right?
attorneys, fair fees, and high level of client service have been rewarded by allowing
Forget
us to
listen to
the end of the competition. We will give you the opportunity to get a fresh start
I love
in a legal and dignified manner.
All right. We should have him with us in just a moment.
In addition to bankruptcy, we can also...
Okay, I'm transferring you through now.
Thank you.
Protect your rights. We are no fee until we win.
This is Rick Gustafson.
Good afternoon. This is Guy James from the Guy James Show.
Hey, how are you, Mr. James?
Very good, very good. Yeah. How are things in Chicago today?
Busy, but a nice weather, finally.
Well, good, good. The Windy City. You're in the Sears Tower, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, how high up are you?
51, 51st floor.
Is it true that on a windy day there are white caps on the toilets there?
Almost. You can feel the building move, which is sort of an eerie feeling. But
I read that someplace once.
So...
We're going live, and we want to thank Richard. You go by Rick?
I go by Rick.
Okay, we'd like to welcome Rick Gustafson, the second to our program today, and we ask him, you can explain what law firm you're with and all that, if you would, please.
Sure, I'm with a law firm called Legal Helpers. We have offices in 19 states across the country, including there in Florida. We specialize in representing individual consumers in filing bankruptcy. So that's either usually Chapter 7 or Chapter 13.
What's the difference between 7 and 13? Would you tell us that? I know it's
sure.
not an easy
explanation. Yeah, Chapter 7 is the type of bankruptcy that most people think about when they think about bankruptcy. The idea there is to eliminate debt, wipe it out, get a fresh start, known as a fresh start bankruptcy or a debt elimination bankruptcy. Chapter 13, on the other hand, is a repayment plan. It's a court-supervised, court-enforced repayment plan that's still filed in bankruptcy court. Both are still bankruptcy processes, but Chapter 13, you're repaying all or a portion of your debt. Chapter 7, you're wiping out everything you can.
Why would you do a 13?
Chapter 13 is the most common reason people decide to do Chapter 13 bankruptcy is because they're needing help getting caught up on their mortgage or their car. And what Chapter 13 allows you to do is, because even in a 7, if you're just wiping out the debt on that, you're not able to stay in your house unless you're current on your payments. So for people who are behind on their payments, and they need help getting caught up, Chapter 13 is the type of bankruptcy that helps them do that. It prevents the foreclosure from happening and allows the person to spread out payments over time to get caught up on what they've fallen behind. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And as so someone comes into your office or maybe your office here in Florida,
right,
and they don't know what to do, where to go, how to proceed. You lay this all out for them, what kind of debt they have, and then advise them on which type of bankruptcy to file, if any at all.
Right. That's exactly right.
The most common of the two would be which?
About 70% of the cases filed across the country are filed under Chapter 7.
And why is that?
Well, a lot of people who maybe haven't fallen behind on their house, but they've got a lot of credit card debt, or they have a lot of other, maybe they've had a car repossessed and the finance company is coming after them for a large deficiency balance, and they can't afford to pay those sorts of debts, but they've got enough money to maybe make the mortgage work and can pay their utilities, but they just don't have any extra to pay the credit cards and whatnot. Chapter 7 is probably going to be the best option for them, because they will be able to come in get rid of those credit card debts and keep the other living expenses that they want, that they're able to handle.
Now, we all heard about the bankruptcy bill that took
Correct.
Place several years ago and how much more Correct. Difficult that made it for people to file personal bankruptcy. Is that, in fact, still the case?
Well, I wouldn't say it made it difficult to file. There are more hoops that have to be jumped through. There's more paperwork that's required. There's the thing that got all the press was the means test. But typically what I see is that people who would have qualified to file before the law change still qualify. It doesn't adversely affect that many people other than the extra requirements regarding paperwork and that kind of thing. So as we've gotten into this and as we've had 4 years of, or 3.5 years, I guess, of application and working through how the numbers work out, what I've seen is most of the folks who qualify for Chapter 7 back before the law change are still going to qualify for Chapter 7 now.
And a lot of people have terrible harassment coming from
right.
from creditors. You put a stop to that. Is that not true?
Correct. Right. The filing a bankruptcy case immediately puts a court order in place that prevents any bill collector. And by the way, even if you wanted the bill collector to still contact you, it prevents any bill collector from contacting you. They can't send you a letter. They can't call you anymore. Certainly, they can't do things like foreclose on a property or garnish wages. All of bankruptcy filing protects you from all of those collection activities.
In Florida, I believe, I don't know how many other states are like it, but in Florida, unless it's your the people that own your mortgage, they can't get your house, can they?
That's correct. In Florida, you have a very generous homestead exemption, which would mean that if a creditor were to obtain a judgment against you, well, it's sort of only partially true. They could still obtain a judgment lien and place a lien against your real estate if they get a judgment against you. But there are things you can do to prevent them from being able to do anything about that. Florida does have a very generous homestead exemption that most other people in other states don't enjoy.
Is there another state that has an exemption like that?
Texas.
Texas
has even a broader homestead exemption than Florida does. And Arizona used to, though the Arizona legislature, I don't know exactly when, but probably about 6 years ago, changed the law to reduce the homestead exemption there. So right now I think the two best are Texas and Florida.
How does a person know what trips the lever? When should they file bankruptcy?
Well, I've always told people, you know, most of my clients come to me probably 6 months after they should have.
Really?
Yeah, because what they, you know, nobody likes to call the bankruptcy lawyer. You know, that's a tough call to make. You know, who wants to pick up the phone and call the bankruptcy lawyer today? I mean, that's generally not something most people are very fond of doing. So a lot of people do everything in their power to avoid that call. Even when they look at their, you know, they look at how much money they're making. They look at what they need to pay in living expenses, and the writing is clear. You know, there's not enough money coming in the door to pay all the debt obligations. Once you've figured that out, it's time to make a call. But a lot of people do things like maybe they'll try to sell assets. Maybe they'll try to, they'll try to do a number of things to prevent having to make the phone call. They'll go borrow more money, and they'll try to get one of these teaser rates, you know, a 0% interest. And they figure, well, if I borrow this and pay off the higher interest rate ones, then I can hold out, you know, then I can make this work. And I suppose maybe that works for some people, but in my view of it is, you know, it doesn't hurt to call and talk to a professional. You know, most bankruptcy lawyers are willing to talk to you over the phone for at least a few minutes and get some idea of what it is a bankruptcy can do for you and whether or not it ought to be something you look into further. So it certainly doesn't hurt to make the call and get some information. And a lot of folks, you know, they're calling me after the creditor has already filed a lawsuit against them or after the, you know, and it usually has to get pretty bad before they get to the point of a lawsuit.
How bad is bad? How tenacious are some of the creditors?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose it does vary. You know, and I'm talking generally about credit cards now, but obviously mortgage companies, their collection process is a little different because they have the, you know, they have the ultimate hammer to hold over your head, and that is foreclosure. But with credit card companies, generally the process is you get 30 days late, they may make a phone call, they may send you a letter, you know, very cordial, you know, you must have forgotten about us kind of thing. Then it goes 60 or 90 days late, then they'll hit you with the, oh, okay, you're in default now, so we're going to raise your interest rate to 20-something percent, and, you know, you're over the limit fee, and you're late charge, and we're going to send this to collections if you don't pay immediately, and then if you still don't pay, then they'll send it to a collection agency, and they'll generally, they're very aggressive about calling at all hours of the day or most of the time, and sending all sorts of nasty letters, and eventually it'll get into a lawyer's hands, and the lawyer will file a lawsuit, and you'll have the sheriff showing up at the door, serving a summons, then, you know, some people, when they appear in court, that's a very intimidating experience to have to show up and have a judge sit there and, you know, get to observe the American court system in action. It's a very intimidating thing for people who don't have a lot of experience with that.
Okay, so that happens, and
right.
they show up and they get a judgment against you from the court, and to what lengths can they go? Do you have an auction at your house and sell everything that you own?
Well, thankfully, most states have some exemption laws in place that allow people who owe money to protect a certain level of necessary household items, you know, so... You know, that will also vary from state to state, by the way, as far as the dollar value of what you can protect from collections. But most states have exemption laws in place so that they're not going to come and sell your bed. But you know, most creditors, what they're going to do once they get a judgment is going to try to, the first thing they'll do is garnish any wages you might have. Generally, they can't take all of your wages, but again, depending on the state, anywhere from 15% of your gross wages or 25% of your net. It all depends on how the statute is written. But they can take, you know, a fairly large chunk of your paycheck until their debt is paid. And that's the most common collection technique used by a creditor once they get a judgment against you, is they're going to want to try to garnish those wages or at least as much of them as they can.
And if you lost your job and don't have one, what then?
Well, good question. You obviously don't have any wages to garnish. They can't garnish unemployment or Social Security type of income. But then what the creditor would do, in my experience, is they will try to freeze your bank account. So if you have a checking account that you may be depositing unemployment funds into, a creditor who obtains a judgment can serve a document on the bank to freeze the bank account. Once they do that, if the debtor does not appear in court to claim whatever funds are in the bank account exempt, then the judge in state court will order the award of the money that's in the bank account to the creditor. So there's just a lot of stuff like that, but if you don't know what you're doing or you don't know what your rights are, that can end up costing you money when it doesn't have to, you know.
All right. The typical person come to see you right now, I suppose, has got if there is a typical person.
It does run. It is ranges pretty widely. But
a load of credit card debt, a load of medical bills. What is the person you see the most today?
I would say most of the time it'd have to be credit cards. You know, there's a variety of reasons and a variety of you know, credit cards are not always spent by people to go buy luxury items and big screen TVs. I mean, most people who have credit card debt do it because they've had to use the credit cards to pay their living expenses or in many cases to pay medical bills. But I would say generally most people who come to see me are going to have credit card debt. You know, if it's not I want to save my house from foreclosure case, you know. But most people who are coming in to do Chapter 7 is usually because of credit card debt.
And what is the remedy for that? How do you proceed with that?
Well, obviously we would take, you know, from a bankruptcy lawyer's perspective, we would want to find out a lot of information from the person about what their assets are, all of the debts they owe, not just the ones they may want to get rid of, but everything they owe we need to know about. There is a policy of full disclosure in bankruptcy court, so you have to disclose all of your assets. And an asset can be anything, not just typically what people think about a house or a car. It can be your furniture, your bank accounts, your a right to inherit money might be an asset. So anything could be considered an asset. So you'd want to go in, make sure you're prepared to tell your lawyer about all of your assets, all of your debts, your income, your living expenses, so that the lawyer can then formulate an opinion for that person about what type of bankruptcy is going to work. And, you know, most people, like I said, about 70% of the people in this country who end up filing bankruptcy file a Chapter 7.
And so when they walk out of the courtroom, if okay, they come in and they've got they owe some medical bills, perhaps a few grand in doctor bills, and $25,000-$30,000 in credit cards. They walk out walk down the courthouse steps after that, free and clear.
Well, the creditors do have some time to object to a bankruptcy if they feel that there's fraudulent stuff going on. So there are some safeguards in the bankruptcy code. It doesn't happen quite like that. Usually the discharge order, which is the final court order that discharges a person of liability in a bankruptcy, gets mailed by the clerk's office after the expiration of some time periods. But generally, once you show up at your hearing and testify about what your assets and debts are to the trustee, a couple of months after that, after those time periods have expired, then you're going to get a letter in the mail that says you're discharged from your debt.
And the question of fraud being involved, what is considered fraud with a credit card?
Well, for instance, if you're not working and you say, let me tell them that I'm working, and let me tell them that I'm making $50,000 a year because I'm hoping they'll give me the credit card when you really have no income, then you've, in effect, lied on your application. And if the creditor relies on that, you know, relies on what you told them as far as your income is and awards and gives you a credit limit based on what you've reported to them, that could be considered fraud.
So if you told them you made 75 and you made 74.5 last year, that's not considered fraud?
I doubt that would lie. I doubt that a judge somewhere would get hung up on that $500.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking something that's material.
Yes.
You know, it has to be a material misstatement of something. Or another situation that could be considered fraudulent is, I'm going to file bankruptcy, but I got about $10,000 left on my credit card limit. Let me go have a party and charge up the remaining $10,000. Or let me go to the gambling boat and see if I can win back all my money. And let me go use up the rest of my $10,000 charge because since I'm filing bankruptcy anyway. That's also considered a form of fraud because what you're doing there is you're not intending to repay the debt. You're intending to incur the debt and turn around and file bankruptcy on it. So that could be considered fraud. Another form of fraud is lying to the bankruptcy court about your assets, which that, in effect, could almost be a criminal situation. Not only could it result in a non-dischargeability complaint filed by the creditor, but it could also result in prosecution by the U.S. attorney. So you certainly don't want to, you know, that basically runs the gamut of, you know, stretching the truth to committing a crime, you know.
Yes.
But certainly not anybody who, just because you want to file bankruptcy, there are qualifications you have to go through. And part of the idea of going to a lawyer and having the lawyer review your situation is so you can get an opinion about what you qualify for.
And are we at an all-time high right now with bankruptcies?
No. The all-time high was in 2005 when, obviously, there was a lot of press about the pending bankruptcy law changes that you had alluded to earlier. So 2005, I think there was something like 2-point-something million bankruptcies filed. My experience in 15 years of doing this is that usually most consumer cases range from about 1.1 to about 1.4 million filings. And that's probably, if you go back and look 1994 onwards, you're going to see somewhere in that number of bankruptcy filings. this year, in 2008, there was about a million. All the official statistics have not been published yet for 2008, but it's about a million bankruptcies were filed in 2008 for consumers. This year, we're probably going to be closer to the 1.3 or 1.4 million based on early returns on the cases that have been filed year to date.
I see that the latest reports have defaults on credit cards up to 9%, even higher with some companies, and it's expected that that's going to be a huge fallout later on this year. Will that tip the scales any further in having bankruptcies filed?
You know, I think there's been some studies that have been done. The most recent one does, that I've seen, does pin the number of bankruptcy filings to the default rate on credit cards. Believe it or not, a lot of people who default on credit cards, the vast majority of people who are in default don't file bankruptcy. You know, I don't know what they do, but they don't file bankruptcy. You know, when you're talking about only 1.1 to 1.4 million people in the country filing a Chapter 7 or 13 bankruptcy, you know, the 9% of all the credit cards out there, that's a lot more than 1.4 million people, you know. But there tends to be some correlation between default rates on credit card payments and bankruptcy filings. So I would think if the default rates are, in fact, increasing to that extent, then you probably are going to see an acceleration of bankruptcy filings.
I would think so. I would think so. And another question I have, someone comes in and they're behind on their mortgage, they're behind on credit card payments, they're covered with debt and they can see no way out. There's obviously expenses involved with an attorney. What if someone's got no money? What type of arrangements do they work out with you?
Well, what I usually see is that even though certainly everybody is worried about the legal expenses, the fact is that if you consider what you've been struggling to pay your credit cards every month, the cost of doing a bankruptcy case is likely less than 2 or 3 months worth of your minimum payments that you've been making on credit card payments.
I see.
So the cost of doing a bankruptcy, you know, having had lots of friends in other areas of law and having myself had to have use lawyers from time to time, you know, most bankruptcy cases that you're going to do under Chapter 7 are less than $2,000, which, you know, sounds like a lot of money if you're having to come up with it out of pocket when you're having trouble paying your minimum payments on your credit cards. But many bankruptcy lawyers offer payment plans, and obviously if you're going to file bankruptcy, you would stop paying the bills that you're filing. And instead of paying them 2 or 3 months, you'd have the money you need to pay your bankruptcy lawyer.
Okay, that makes sense. The other question is, first of all, a lot of people say, well, if I file bankruptcy, I'm ruined. My credit's ruined forever. I'm just done for. Is that the case?
Well, actually not. I mean, what's interesting about this is your credit can be ruined by a lot of other things besides filing bankruptcy. For instance, being in default on a credit card payment ruins your credit. Having too much debt ruins your credit. The credit score is made up of a number of factors, payment history, debt-to-income ratio being the two biggest, but there's lots of other factors that go into it. What your income is goes into it. So your credit is, my opinion is, once somebody picks up the phone and calls a bankruptcy lawyer and comes into the sees a bankruptcy lawyer, their credit, if not already bad, is about to be bad already. So bankruptcy, in my opinion, is the first step toward getting you in a position where you can start to rebuild a better score, because you've got to get out of debt. If you're not out of debt and you continually are in default, your credit score goes nowhere except down. And until you can get rid of the debt and start doing something to maintain a regular payment history, you're not going to be able to rebuild it. And for many people who don't have the means of otherwise getting out of debt, bankruptcy can be the first step toward rebuilding your credit. Now, it's true. Bankruptcy gets reported on your credit report. That's true. But like I said, so do default payments, and so do foreclosures, and so do lawsuits. So bankruptcy is not not the end of the world. Bankruptcy is the new beginning. And that's what I, and it, there's actually a recent study I saw that, a company has come out with that indicates that, about 90% of bankruptcy, people who successfully complete a bankruptcy case, within 6 months after the bankruptcy, their credit score is better by an average of 80 points than what it was before they filed. So the myth that bankruptcy ruins your credit is, in my opinion, exactly that, a myth.
What about the stigma?
Well, I mean, stigma, I think, relates to credit reporting. I mean, you don't, you know, you're not going to, it's not a crime to file bankruptcy.
Your friends, your neighbors.
Well, how are they going to know unless you tell them?
It's not in the newspaper?
So it is true that there, it is public record. So anybody who wants to find out if somebody filed bankruptcy can do that. I suppose if it's a slow news day, a newspaper reporter may hang out at the bankruptcy court and find out who filed bankruptcy and report on that. And I have seen, in some cases, some newspapers have a section at the back with the classified ads that publish in there all the new, all the bankruptcy filings. So that's a possibility. But, again, the lawsuit gets published, too, you know, because you didn't pay Citibank. Citibank sues you. That's published. That's public record. So I don't know how you're going to be able to necessarily avoid the stigma. And the other thing about that is, what's interesting is no one seems to mind that much if United Airlines files a bankruptcy. You know, oh, well, it's just a business decision they're making. They're trying to help their company improve, and that's why they're filing bankruptcy, and we're still packing United's airplanes.
Right.
Maybe not to the extent they want to, but we're still packing their airplanes. I just flew United not too long ago, and every seat was taken in the plane. But if an individual files bankruptcy, and most individuals don't get to play around with $65 billion a year in revenue, somehow society has to cast some sort of judgment against that person. Doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't.
You know, I really don't understand it. I mean, I understand why people would feel bad about making maybe some bad decisions in their own personal finances and feeling guilty about that. I get that. But a stigma seems to suggest that somehow you're a lesser person because you filed bankruptcy, and I don't buy it.
Well, it would seem to me there's safety in numbers nowadays.
I suppose that's also part of it. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Join the crowd, I guess, right?
Yes.
Jump on the bandwagon, I suppose.
Well, in a couple of minutes that we've got left, tell us, for people who are troubled with debt and all, what's their first step in for, with your firm?
Well, the way we would do it is you would call. Talk to somebody for, you know, 5 minutes or so over the phone to get a general understanding of the situation. You know, we have some highly trained staff that can kind of go through, get some information from the person, and get a good understanding of what their situation is. And then we offer a free consultation. You could come into one of our offices, sit down with one of my lawyers. We'll go through the details of the situation, offer advice, obviously, for no obligation. And we... you know, quote all fees and costs up front in writing. We typically charge a flat fee, so you're not going to be paying an hourly rate. You know, different bankruptcy lawyers will do it differently, but this is just how we do it. You'll either at that point decide you don't want to retain services and, you know, the information is free, or at that point you can decide to retain us to do a bankruptcy case. And typically what we do is you start off with a small down payment and you can make payments on the fee over time. Which, again, makes it goes to your affordability question. You know?
And how soon after that do people have relief from the bill collectors calling and all that?
Well, what's interesting is once you've retained an attorney to represent you, there is another federal law out there called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which does not require you to file a bankruptcy to have some level of relief from the creditor harassment that you may be experiencing. Once you have retained counsel to represent you, generally, a bill collector, which are usually third-party lawyers or collection agencies, can no longer call you on the phone. They have to call your lawyer. So there's some immediate relief you get while you're trying to pay your lawyer's fees off. And then from there, once you've paid whatever fees and costs are required, paperwork gets drafted, signed, and filed with the court. And we can do that in as little as a day, depending on how fast the client needs it done.
How long does the whole process take normally?
Well, the Chapter 7, you're talking about from the date of the filing until the date that you get the discharge order in the mail is usually about 4 months. If you're talking about a Chapter 13 repayment plan, the discharge doesn't come out until you've completed your plan payments. And most Chapter 13 plan payments range from 3 to 5 years. So since that's a repayment type of a situation, you know, you're not getting it. You're not just showing up, disclosing, and walking away. At 13, you're making some payments over time. But usually that's a 3 to 5 year process.
Do you have advice for anybody? I see there are many, many, many solicitations now on TV, radio, newspaper, all over the place about come see us, we'll consolidate your debts, we'll make a deal with the bank, you know, we'll make a deal with your credit card companies, you pay us, and we'll get them for pennies on the dollars to take care of you. Is there any credence to that?
Oh, that's a pet peeve of mine. you know, I'm not going to say it never works, because I know it has worked for some people. But here's the deal with those. There's no court governing the process. It is a completely voluntary arrangement between you and the creditor, and if you're working through a middleman, one of these credit counseling agencies, then they negotiate the deal for you or whatever the case may be. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But my experience is you end up paying that negotiator a lot more money than you pay a lawyer to do a bankruptcy case for you, and you end up paying your creditors a lot more money than you end up paying them in a bankruptcy case. And it still adversely affects your credit because all of your creditors are still in default. And you may incur tax implications, especially if you're in a settlement situation. In other words, the debt that you settled out of can be reported to the IRS as taxable income. So, you know, there's a lot of things that happen going through one of those programs that doesn't happen in bankruptcy. So I, in almost universally situations I've seen, the result in a bankruptcy would have been better than the result obtained by going through a credit counselor or a debt settlement company. The only thing you're avoiding by doing that instead of bankruptcy is the fact that you filed bankruptcy.
Yes.
You know, and to some people that's valuable, and I don't want to downplay that, but the fact of the matter is, as an economic proposition, you know, I have X amount of dollars and I have Y amount of debt, you're almost always going to be better off in a bankruptcy than one of those sorts of programs. Another interesting tidbit, a lot of those companies approach, you know, their marketing as, oh, we're a not-for-profit company. Well, not-for-profit doesn't mean free. They still charge a fee for their services. And a lot of people don't realize that. You know, they think, oh, it's not-for-profit. Somehow that means they're the good guys and they're not going to charge me anything. You know, but that's not true. They do charge a fee. And it's simply a process where there's no guarantee of success.
Good. Well, I've wondered about that a long time. I've heard about these and just see the ads for them all the time.
Right. A lot of them are funded by your credit card companies, by the way.
Really?
I just saw an article. I was combing the internet preparing for our interview, and I just saw an article. And I wish I could remember where I saw it, but there was an article, on CNN.com. It talked about there's this new website out where one of the banks has set up this website where they give you links to all these different debt settlement and credit card or credit counseling agencies. And the whole premise is, see, look, we're going to provide this other way for you to work things out with us and look at how nice we're being and all that kind of stuff. And all it is, it's a ploy to get you to pay an extra few months of your credit card debt, and you're going to end up in bankruptcy anyway.
Yeah.
Usually. So it was interesting, you know, the CNN commentator, you know, on CNN.com had some interesting things to say about it. And there was also an IRS investigation done against some of these credit counseling agencies that touted themselves as not-for-profit 501c3 organizations. And the IRS had some interesting recommendations of about 80% of the companies it investigated. Recommendations to remove their 501c3 status.
Oh, yeah, it is interesting.
So there's a lot of stuff on there. You know, again, I don't want to get, you know, it does work for some people. It is a way for some people to stay out of bankruptcy. You know, I don't want to come across as, oh, yeah, you're the bankruptcy lawyer. Of course you're going to say that. But just from my experience, you're almost always going to end up in, as an economic proposition, better off in bankruptcy. And because in bankruptcy, it's a court process. So what happens is what, you know, what we say happens is based on a knowledge of what happens under the law, and that is what's going to happen. It's not, well, we like you, so we'll let you pay this for 6 months, and then, oh, well, we're sick of that, so now we're going to cut the deal different because it's a voluntary process, you know, and that sometimes does happen with these credit counseling things.
Well, Rick, tell us about your company, how listeners can get a hold of you. Do you have a website?
We certainly do. Our website is at www.legalhelpers.com. We have a toll-free phone number if a listener wants to pick up the phone and call, and we can, we'll be happy to, you know, try to give them a quick idea of what we can do for them. It's 888-743-5787. Like I said, we have offices in 19 states, so even if you're not in Florida and happen to be hearing the broadcast, give us a call, and if we can't help you, we can probably point you in the right direction. So,
where's your office in Florida?
We have offices in Tampa. We have an office in Orlando. We have an office in Lakeland. We have an office in Fort Lauderdale. We've got an office in Hollywood. So several offices across the state.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, this program is streamed live, so people in all the states are hearing it. So,
great.
888-743-5787. That's
right.
legalhelpers.com. And
yes,
there'll be a lot of information on there. Rick, thank you. This has been a great interview. I know many of my listeners have found out things they had no idea about, and I have too. And you've been forthright and right up front about everything, about your charges, how you do everything, and I appreciate that very much, and thank you for a great interview.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me, and I wish your listeners all the best. Hopefully they can avoid some of these economic bad news we keep hearing about every day.
That would
so
be good.
I wish everyone the best.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, thank you.
Rick Gustafson II, coming to you from LegalHelpers.com. I found that very interesting. I hope you did as well. I learned a lot that I certainly did not know, the difference between a 7 and a 13 and all that. Most interesting to me, anyway. I hope you enjoyed it as well. I must say, charges are less than I thought they would be. I've always wondered about that. People filing bankruptcy, now they're filing bankruptcy because they don't have any money. How do you pay a lawyer? Well, it seemed perfectly reasonable what his answer was. So that was very interesting for me. 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254, if you'd like to join the program. Listen, I have to expose, and I hope you don't mind, expose Mr. Limbaugh one more time. If he isn't the biggest horse's ass that ever lived, I'd like to know who is. Well, maybe Glenn Beck is, and I won't get into that right now, but Rush Limbaugh, during this kidnapping, during this pirate deal that was going on off of the coast of Somalia, had a good time, as did all the right-wing talkers, a good time saying that, oh, here we have another Democrat not willing to do anything, is soft, and people are taking advantage of him, and Obama can't do anything, and here this poor captain's at these pirates' mercy, and it went on and on and on and on. How about how Obama was impotent to do anything about it? Just another liberal who can't be tough. That was the theme from Rush Limbaugh. That was the theme from Hannity, from all of them. You know who I'm talking about. The whole bunch of them. And so they lead a highly successful rescue mission. Whereas these three pirates were shot and killed by these amazing marksmen. I just can't get over a boat that's bobbing in the water. It's an incredible story that these guys are marksmen that are that good. These are people that should have access to guns, okay? The Navy SEALs, I think they were the very best marksmen, did this. They pulled off three simultaneous shots as though it were one, from what I hear, and killed these three guys. And what is Limbaugh's response? First of all, so the ones that were on before him, they were going that, well, you know, Obama, he didn't really give the order for this. He did no squat about this whole thing. He just told them, okay, do something, and he didn't know anything. Well, turns out that he did. And now we have Rush Limbaugh on the air seriously suggesting that it was wrong to kill three black teenagers, and I understand these people were young. Now, oh, they killed three black teenagers. Oh boy, that's really bad. Would they have killed three white teenagers? Would they kill? If I've ever heard anything, even during his most drug-induced rants, and there were many. I used to love to listen to it when he was really on the pills, because it came across loud and clear. Slurring his words. If there's ever a statement to discredit him completely, fully, and forever, this should be it. This should be it. He is a horse's ass of the highest order. The statement about killing three black teenagers, like, oh, how could Obama win with him? How could Obama win with Limbaugh? He could not, and that's the point. He could not win if the economy improved to the point where everybody in the country had $1 million cash in their dresser drawer, two chickens every pot, and a car in every garage, and lived happily ever after. Limbaugh and his ilk would find a way to bitch and moan and complain about it. And that's what makes the man just so terribly disgusting, what he said yesterday. I don't know how, after the statement yesterday about killing the three black teenagers, I don't know how anyone, any thinking human being, could ever take anything that man says seriously ever again. Ever. Am I over the top here? Am I unreasonable here? Because if that isn't the attitude of a real horse's ass, I don't know what is. He pretty much told Obama, heads you lose, tails you lose. I don't care what you do, you're not going to do anything. And no, I don't sit around and listen to Rush Limbaugh. I usually am tipped off to something and go find the audio, which is easy enough to do. This whole thing, the past couple of days, these tea parties, and you'll have to admit, the right now is radical. They are extremists, and they're going nuts. I have never in my adult life, since I've been interested in politics, and I wasn't even an adult when I got interested in politics, I have never seen the screeching be like it is now. Never. They lost. They've lost it all. They're losing their party. They're losing their credibility. I think they're losing it. I think they're just losing it. And I think eventually that man will lose it as well, that Limbaugh. So I just had to comment about that. I know people listen to him, and I know he's a god to a lot of people. And I also know that he is, in fact, the titular head of the Republican Party. Anybody that denies that is a liar. He is the head of the Republican Party. And I know a lot of them don't want to admit to that, but it's the truth. So, Rushy Boy, and Glenn Beck, and Neil Cavuto. Cavuto probably was... He probably did himself a lot of damage yesterday. I don't know how it was in your city. It was a bit hard for me to take here locally because our local radio station, the right-wing station here that is radical extremist right-wing all day, every day, weekends and all, they go at it. You've got your Limbaugh and your Savage and your Mark Levin and Dennis Prager. And then they're all on here. This is right-wing heaven. There isn't any question about it. This is right-wing heaven. And it troubles me as I walk the streets and I see people here, knowing that two out of every three people I pass is one of them. One of them. One of those who will listen to a Rush Limbaugh and take him seriously and repeat what he has to say. The letters to the editor in the local newspaper, they're good for comedy. They really are. I should get some of them and read them someday. It's incredible what people will write to the local newspaper here, but they're in friendly confines here. They know it, and they get away with just about anything in the newspaper. And the right-wing radio station crowing today about the massive crowd they had yesterday. The crowd was nowhere near what they claimed it was. And, yes, I do believe that was not un-American activity yesterday in many ways. I believe in free speech, but a lot of it was just plain un-American. And they'll have to live with that. Hey, I want to thank you for listening to the program today. And I want to thank Johnny and Sophie and Chuck and John and Robert and who else? All for Sue from California. For priming the pump on our fundraiser. I appreciate your help more than I can tell you. And I try and get back to each and every one of you, but I appreciate it so very much. It is a listener-supported program. You can do so, and I hope you will, and maybe encourage others to do it because it's a matter of urgency right now. At theguyjamesshow.com, theguyjamesshow.com, there's a place you can go on there and make a one-time or a monthly donation. And visit the blog, theguyjamesshow.com/blog. I hope you will, and I'll try and post later on this evening some results from our fundraising drive that we're having right now. So, you are listening to The Guy James Show. Interesting day with Dr. Boer, the microbiologist. Very interesting man and very engaging man. And also with Rick, the attorney, about the bankruptcy. I enjoyed both of those very, very much, talking to those gentlemen. They're the kind of guys I like to talk to, just, real. Both of them were very, very real and down to earth, and I enjoy that very much. So thank you. You're listening to The Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network. Stay tuned for Mark and then Bob, and we'll see you later. And never forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth.
Shoo-ba-doo, da-ba-da-da, shoo-ba-doo, da-ba-da-da-doo.